From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm trying to follow some listeners' requests for me to slow down a little. Is that better?
Oh, I'll do that too then. I got that feedback recently as well.
Yeah. So, how are you, Megan Mack?
I'm doing well, thanks. This is the smooth jazz hour coming up shortly here.
Yeah.
But it's been a beautiful week here in Western New York.
Yes, we should talk
All jokes
normal.
Aside.
Yes, it is.
And a lot of people are talking about the weather, of course. And while we don't want to confuse weather with climate, we thought that it would be a good place to start. We welcome Steve Curwood to the show. He's the longtime host of Living on Earth, heard on more than 300 NPR stations.
Curwood launched his show back in 1990, back when very few people were talking about climate change. But he was, and I wanted to know how this journalist ended up focused on climate change a full 27 years ago.
Well, I had, as a kid, I'd covered air pollution as an intern on Capitol Hill. And I was looking for a book project, long story short. My kid said, you got to do something about the environment. So I went back to look at air quality and discovered, OMG, this climate thing is huge.
In 1990.
I went down to Woods Hole to see a guy by the name of George Woodwell, who was running the Woods Hole Research Center. I was told he was the expert. And again, to make a long story short, he said, the big problem with climate change is that the warming will be in a feedback loop. The warmer it gets, the warmer it'll make us, because as we start to melt the Arctic and release more and more carbon, and it'll at some point it becomes a runaway reaction we can't stop in sort of the human scale. I'm sure, you know, a couple of million years we'll be fine. But and that immediately opened my eyes, because I've been a journalist, worked at the Boston Globe, where my mentor said the reason that we have the press mentioned in the Constitution is that you got to have an informed public if you're going to have a successful democracy. And I said, climate disruption is the biggest story I've ever heard of. It is going to trump war, peace, economics. If we get the climate thing wrong, the rest of the stuff doesn't really matter. So I got going as a journalist on this. And I have to say, Evan, to be candid about something that can be a little bit awkward, people say to me sometimes, you know, you're a black guy, and how many... You look around the environmental community, I mean, how many greenies are people of color, I mean, other than green? And I said, well, you know, coming from a black America, we've had really talented people discounted unfairly because of their color. And the people discounting the environmental story because whatever, you know, feels right to me that I should be working in this area. Because even though people aren't paying attention, you quoted the stats of how interested people are, and actually things got way worse because the fossil fuel industry started a whole disinformation campaign that's been very powerful and still has some people confused. But I said, as a journalist, it's my responsibility. People ask me, are you an environmentalist? I said, no, I'm a journalist. The subjects of environmental change, in particular climate, are so important that they have to be covered. We have to understand.
And you look at how forward thinking Steve Curwood was, well, and is, but was in 1990. I mean, I think you talked to, among other people, Jesse Jackson and others about the impacts of environmental degradation on vulnerable communities, often communities of color, communities in poverty, coastal communities. You were thinking about those things long before most people were really even aware of some of the terminology. And here we are today having a conversation. We had a conversation last month with the president of the Sierra Club, who had a lot to say, Aaron Maher, as a man of color, talking about his own journey as an African-American man in that sort of environment, in that system, understanding just how vulnerable communities can be. He saw it in the Albany area. He sees it around the world now. He has it in his heart. He wants to make it a movement that's not just a white movement. But you were thinking about this in 1990. I wonder what you remember. People were people saying to you, what is it? What are you talking about? Was it sort of kind of an interesting reaction from the public and from your peers in journalism?
Well, yes, some people. But we were able to resonate with quite a few people there. I mean, we started the show. We got 100 stations signed up. People, I think, on a fundamental level, felt that things were out of balance, that there's just something that wasn't quite right. We did this around there was a big brouhaha. Well, no, brouhaha is the wrong word. There was a lot of excitement around Earth Day in 1990, the 20th anniversary. And so people were looking, and the big Exxon Valdez spill, people just had a sense, okay, something's out of kilter here. What should we do? So a lot of folks on public radio are curious, as you know. So we got an excellent response from that.
Next, we talked to award-winning filmmaker Steve James. He's the director of the 1994 classic Hoop Dreams, and his newest film is called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. That's a riff off the cliche about Wall Street, too big to fail. Abacus is a small bank in Chinatown, and it's the only bank that was criminally charged after the financial crisis.
But James' film argues that Abacus was unfairly targeted, all while our tax dollars bailed out the truly criminal big banks on Wall Street. James was in Rochester for the One Take Film Festival, which is showing both Hoop Dreams and Abacus.
I hope this story, which could be considered just a footnote in the banking crisis stemming from 2008, I think is more than a footnote. I think it's very revealing, and it was an important story to tell because it wasn't being told otherwise. The failure of the mainstream media to even tell this story is something, and I'm glad we got the opportunity to do that. I do think I agree with Matt Taibbi in that this is an example of the unequal application of justice in this country, and it just so happens that the Sungs were indeed not willing to buckle, take a plea deal. You know, they weren't even offered the same plea deals that the big banks were. They were offered, agree to a felony and a fine, and then you're fine. You know, then you can walk away. But that just reveals that it was all about getting that conviction, and I think making something of being the guy who had brought a bank to its heels in the wake of this crisis. I mean, he had federal justice people behind him when he announced the indictment. It was all connected to that, and so I think that this is an important story to tell in that regard. And the Sungs were just not willing to give up. The fact that they were willing to put their money, millions of dollars, these were not poor people, which usually are the people who are most victimized by the unequal application of justice. They were not that, and thank God, because they were able to effectively fight back. And I think the other thing that's really important to me in this story is as a profile of this very resilient and courageous and quite entertaining family. You know, it's a portrait of Chinese Americans that I am told by a number of Chinese Americans who have attended screenings at festivals and such that they just haven't seen, and they're really glad to see, you know, in a film, because we have such sort of rigid stereotypes about what it means to be a Chinese American in this country.
We turn now to Rochester schools, where you're likely to find students sitting in a circle on any given day. That's because 26 Rochester schools now use restorative circles, which are designed to let people face one another after a conflict.
The idea is simple. It's more effective to use a restorative circle than just to suspend anyone who does wrong. Here's Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute, and then Ruth Turner from the Rochester City School District.
A restorative circle is sitting down in a formal way with the people that were involved in the harm, a facilitator, and there's a set of questions, and it's a process that has gone through, and it's used in schools, it's used in courts here, it's used in faith communities, it's being widely more and more used.
Also, an important element to that is that when you sit in circle, regardless of your title, regardless of your age, we're all equal in a circle. So, you know, I don't come in a circle as executive director or teacher. We're all equal. Everybody's voice has the same level of importance. And that's the difference between merely just sitting in a
circle. There's no head of a circle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, interesting. And so here is...
Interesting and threatening.
And threatening?
For some. I mean, if you're only trust that you matter because of your role or your rank, and suddenly you're asked to go into a space where you're on the same human level with everybody else, for some that's a big pill to swallow. So I just want to acknowledge it's not the easiest thing to, you know, you can just sit here and be kind of innocent and naive and say, we just sit down and we're all equal. That's hard for some of us and for most of us, but for some it's harder than others, especially when you don't trust that you're going to matter without your rank, without your role.
That's actually a very good, if I could just take a second to just share a story that just triggered my memory. We were doing some work with a particular high school in the city, and the school leader was like, you know, I'm really interested to hear what our students think about our school and what needs to happen. I'm really interested in having a circle and sitting down with them. And we really prepared her to say, okay, you know, people can say anything. They speak from the heart in the circle, and you got to make sure you're prepared for that, not to take it personal. And it was really just great to see students give their principal feedback and say, hey, this is what's working in our school, you know, as we circled up. This is what's not working. These are some changes we need to make. And then being able to give that feedback to the principal, knowing that they're being heard. And it was really sobering for her to look back and say, wow, you know, I've never thought about capturing our students' voice in this kind of a way and taking that back to the teacher and the school system and saying, okay, these are some changes we need to make because this is how our students feel, this is their perception, and this is what they need.
Well, we open with the environment. Let's close with the environment and an unlikely story about LL Cool J. But before we get there, a little background. Several local organizations recently announced that they're going to try to go zero waste. Both the Brighton School District and CMAQ are going zero waste, which means trying to almost eliminate sending anything to landfills. They can't stop everything, but they can do a lot more.
And think about what that means at a concert venue like CMAQ, where people are used to drinking and tossing bottles in garbage cans. It's a significant change, and it turns out that the story of how this came to be is a fun one. Here's Lynn Frieda from CMAQ.
It came up during the off season, probably in the winter time. One of the artists that we were looking at actually has an environmental rider and had a lot of requests.
This is cool. I love this story.
It's pretty cool.
Are you allowed to say who it is?
It was Jack Johnson.
Okay.
We did not secure him this year, but we're hoping what we're doing will bring him to the venue next year.
Wait, did he not come because of the environmental situation?
Not because of the environmental.
Okay.
It just didn't work in routing.
Just didn't work in routing. Okay.
So that made us really take a look at it. We've seen over the years when artists come, even in the backstage area, they'll ask to have water not in plastic bottles, to have us use reusable cups and things like that. So we have to change everything on a different show based on the artist and what the requests are. So we decided, well, if that's what they're looking for, why don't we just actually take a bigger look at this and see how we can turn the whole venue around? We should be doing this anyways.
All right, so this is a great story. Let's peel this back a little bit. First of all, because we hear a lot about riders, but we don't often get to see what they look like. So are more artists bringing in these environmental concerns?
They are.
They are.
Jack Johnson is definitely a leader in the industry. He has his own environmental rider that even to accept the offer. So to even take a look at it, we had to go back and it was an 8-page rider and we had to detail out what we would be doing to meet those environmental requirements. And that's really how the conversation started with Impact Earth. And once talking to them and realizing that it's something that we could do for the full season, it really makes sense for us to do. That's really when we got the conversation going and made it into a larger initiative.
What are some of those items on his list then?
There was things from like the toilet paper needed to be recycled toilet paper, water stations throughout the venue. They request that they do not sell any single-time use plastic bottles during the show that he's at. Even like LED lighting, if that would be an opportunity at the venue, back of house. So just a lot of different things that some of them, things that we're already doing and others would be out-of-the-box requests. But we go through line by line and figure out, we can't do this, but we can do this. And it's the same for every artist. We do as much as we possibly can and come up with alternatives if there's something that we can't do. And so really, his rider was the catalyst, though, to start these initiatives. And I think now we really have everyone wrapped around and everyone's really excited to see how it goes this season.
What's the weirdest rider you ever got, by the way, unrelated to the environment?
I wish I had a better story. They're all pretty normal. I would say LL Cool J, he asked for a dozen roses, which I thought was bizarre, but he actually handed them out to women in the audience, which was also a little bizarre. So.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on AM 1370. WRUR, I lost it for a second. 88.5 FM, that's WRUR, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.